Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Why did Jesus ask so many questions as we read the Gospels? And we'll ask that question to Elizabeth Dias. She covers religion and politics for Time magazine, and she's also the editor and the organizer of a new book called What Did Jesus Ask? And the subtitle is Christian Leaders Reflect on His Questions of Faith. So we're going to take a look at some of the many, many questions that Jesus asked as reported in the Gospels, and discuss what some of the Christian leaders in this book wrote about these questions. And to join us in the conversation, of course, is Elizabeth Dias. Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking time to visit with us here in Chapel Hill today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about this book, What Did Jesus Ask?, how it got started, how you got recruited to be the editor and organizer, and just how much trouble was it to corral, I think, more than 70 busy people from all walks of life whom you call Christian leaders to write something about Jesus's questions. Tell us about this project.
Well, it was a lot of fun. I cover religion and politics for Time magazine, and so I get to interact with all of these Christian leaders often in my reporting, but it's rare, I've noticed, for all of them to come together in a project like this. So I actually have a Master's of Divinity. I went to Princeton Seminary, and funny, you think you know a lot about the Gospels, and you always learn something new. I wasn't really tuned in to the fact that Jesus asked so many questions as part of his life and ministry. You often think of Jesus as a teacher, which he was, and yet he was also a question asker. So I was talking with our editor here just about the fact that Jesus asked so many questions, and we started brainstorming what kind of project could we do to explore that theme. And so I thought, well, why not bring together this generation, this time, Christian leaders from all walks of life, be they evangelical, Catholic, Protestant, all races around the globe, really. We have contributors from Uganda to northeastern Georgia, and representing artists, writers, musicians, comic strip artists, bring them all together to reflect on this together, to really think, what did Jesus ask and what does it mean for today? So the contributors are lots of fun, and everyone was really enthusiastic about the project, which was always fun for an editor. But we've got everyone from Marilyn Robinson to Lecrae, the rapper, Amy Grant, Phyllis Tickle, and 65, 70 others. So it's a real collection. And as well, there's some new voices in here. So we wanted to broaden sort of who's reflecting on this and to bring them together as a group.
Well, you, as a writer and editor for Time in the religion area, you know that people who call themselves Christians and followers of Jesus don't always have the same idea about who Jesus is, was, meant, and what his fundamental basic messages were. Is there a diversity in outlook about those questions as reflected by the writers, or did they all pretty much come to a similar idea about who this questioning teacher was?
Well, I think if we drill down to it, certainly there are differences. Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who is sort of the Pope of the whole of Eastern Christendom, is represented in the book, and I would imagine, he has some different theological views than, say, one of the evangelical writers or things like that. But what was most interesting was the commonalities as opposed to the divisions, because people come together around the person of Jesus, and they came together really around a question and these different questions versus answers. And that's something that is just a different perspective to bring. And I asked all of them, instead of focusing on answering the question in their meditation and reflection, I asked them to focus on hearing the question in their own life. So that really brings it together. So each author selected a question that Jesus asked that resonated with them. And fortunately, there wasn't too much overlap. Everyone got pretty much the question they wanted and then reflected on it. So that style and posture of reflection really brought people together.
Well, that's really interesting. And I was curious about the methodology and how you assigned the questions. And so, what did you just go through the Bible and redline the Gospels and redline where Jesus asked a question, put them on a big sheet of paper, and send them to these people who you thought would be whose commentary would be instructive and useful and inspiring, and let them pick out which one of those questions they thought they might like to comment on. Is that how it worked?
Exactly. That's how it worked. Yeah, so we started with one really big spreadsheet. And, you know, it's interesting. Jesus asked some questions multiple times, or at least different Gospels record them. A question that appears in Luke might also appear in Mark. And so I only selected about 70 questions, just so we had breadth and diversity of questions. And then it was fascinating to watch, you know, who wanted to reflect on which question. And it was surprising, you know, the questions themselves. I mean, let me just share a few. You know, what is your name? Who touched my clothes? Why all this commotion and wailing? Why are you bothering this woman? There's such a range of questions beyond some of the more classic questions that many people might know, like, my God, why have you forsaken me? And once you start to hear how often Jesus asked questions to his disciples, to big crowds following him on the shores of Galilee, to even a question he asked as an adolescent in the temple when his parents were looking for him. Didn't you know I'd be in my father's house? So his whole life was marked by these questions.
Well, it's interesting. There are a whole variety of questions. Some, when I started reading your book and hearing about it, I thought, well, gosh, Jesus is like Socrates. Socrates liked to teach by asking questions. And then I thought about some of my best teachers, or the teachers that I remembered, particularly in law school. They would never tell you the answer. They would only give you a question that didn't have a ready answer, and let you perk on it a while. And this, some of these are Jesus' teaching questions, and some of them just seem like sort of human questions, like, why in the world are you acting this way, kind of thing.
It's true. No, it's really true. And it's a reminder, too, of just how human Jesus was. And he had flesh and blood and lived with people and interacted with them. And we hear that in his questions. And also, though, their questions, as the rest of the scripture is, you know, it's heard anew with every generation. You know, it's lasted for centuries, millennia, and it's the responsibility then of each generation of faithful to internalize the teachings and the questions and to make them their own and then pass on that tradition to the next generation. So this collection really is a snapshot of where today's Christian leaders are. And how they are living and questioning and reflecting on Jesus, the question asker.
Well, you mentioned that Amy Grant is a contributor, and maybe a surprise contributor for some people who admire her life and her singing, but don't think of her as a theological leader. And she chose the question, do you understand what I have done for you? And this was in the Gospel of John, Jesus had washed his disciples' feet. So I never even focused on this particular, this particular question that Jesus asked. Do you understand?
It's true. You always find ones that surprise you.
What I've done for you. Now, what did you think? What would have been your answer? And how did Amy Grant deal with this question? If you remember, I mean, I know you remember because you've
right.
been
no,
over it.
No, no. Amy, it's funny you mentioned people don't think of her as a theologian, but she has such a following, and people sing her songs and worship so often in churches, and she's really formed the spiritual lives of so many Americans. The question she chose, do you understand what I have done for you? She took a very personal route. It's almost like she let us in on a moment of meditation that she was having, and she wrote very tenderly about finding God in nature. And when she feels God's presence is sometimes when she's outside. And she wrote, being out in nature feels like being a guest in God's house and sort of being overwhelmed and so touched by the natural world as a gift from God. So I thought that was such an interesting take. And we're really glad to have her voice in here. And part of it, too, is to show the breadth of kinds of Christian expression that are all around us, whether it's in music or in visual art. We have a visual artist painter in here, and as I said, we have a comic strip artist. So these are all influences for people's daily spirituality that carries a lot of weight, even if it's not your typical theologically trained PhD from an elite university.
Yeah. Well, and this help me with this part of Amy Grant's dealing with this question, which started out sort of with a foot washing experience, which would open the door to for some Christian leaders to deal with all sorts of questions. Either whether foot washing should be a part of a ritual of the church, or whether or not this expresses how we have to serve others. Amy took it in Amy passed those possibilities by and just went straight to nature and the God's gift. And she took a wonderful broad question about do we really understand what God has given us, and just go outside and relate to nature, and you see part of that gift. But she passed by the foot washing experience altogether, sort of, didn't she?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the goal of the book is to hear Jesus' questions in a modern context, and to understand where they come from and the context in which they were asked. And she talks about when Jesus asked the disciples after he washed their feet the night he was betrayed, "Do you know what I've done for you?" And to imagine what it is to hear Jesus asking her that question, "Do you understand what I've done for you?" And then to share that reflection. So I see it just as a reminder of the living nature of these questions. And not abandoning where they come from or the context in which they're asked, but to see sort of the broad application. And in her case, the spiritual life that really comes from this question in unexpected ways.
Well, if you joined us late, we're visiting with Elizabeth Dias. She is the editor and the compiler and the constructor of a new book called What Did Jesus Ask? Christian Leaders Reflect on His Questions of Faith. And she and I'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Elizabeth Dias. She is an editor and writer for Time Magazine covering religion and politics, but we're talking about religion today because she has edited a book with contributions from many Christian leaders. The book is What Did Jesus Ask? And it focuses on the many, many questions that Jesus asked. And we'll have time to talk about some of them. Elizabeth, I'd love to talk about two of the contributors from our area. One is a friend of mine from way back, Lauren Winner, who asked the question, and she's on the faculty at Duke in the Divinity School. And she chose, I've learned, this question, and it made a response: "Why did you break the command of God for the sake of your religion?" And Elizabeth, why did she choose? Well, you don't know why she chose it, but how did Lauren deal with that? Where did that question come from, and how did Lauren deal with it?
Well, this is a question that Jesus asked in conversation with the Pharisees, the religious leaders of his day. And he said, you know, "Why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition?" And Lauren's expertise really is in many ways spirituality and understanding historically Jewish traditions and how they intersected with Christ's work. So it was really interesting. I'm glad she picked this question because there are so many traditions that people have today in the mainstream religious Christian communities. And, you know, that's what Jesus was doing. He was asking the mainstream religious communities of his day about why they were breaking the command of God on behalf of tradition. And so it's not something that we might necessarily think about, but the rituals that have developed in the last 2,000 years of Christian faith, you know, really are ripe to be questioned in a way that just in a similar way that Jesus asked this question. So I was glad that she took it on, and she even brought up you know, everything from Martin Luther King Jr.'s work questioning society's actions during his day for justice. And she says Jesus and the Pharisees differed on tactics. So there's method involved to how people live their faith. So hers is it weaves in a bit more of the academic, scholarly side about what Judaism was and how Jesus wasn't abandoning Judaism at all in asking this question, but trying to get people to understand, you know, how faith is lived in relation to what we think faith is about.
Well, Lauren brings, I mean, a maybe not unique, but brings a special viewpoint in, if I remember this right, she grew up in the Jewish tradition, became Christian, and now has become one of your Christian leaders, but would be a very influential person who's had a complicated experience. And it intersects in the same, in many of the same ways, it seems to me, that Jesus' experience in terms of breaking away in some respects with the way that he was, religion in which he was raised, and at the same time holding on to the basic tenets.
Right.
But this question of the Pharisees of saying, you know, why are you using scripture to justify breaking the real commands of God? It's a tough thing. Well, how do you view this now? How do you hear how Lauren and I view this? How do you view this particular passage?
Well, I was really interested, and she talks about how intention is so important, not just the act itself, because there's ways of doing everything from eating and walking to sleeping. And she says, and this is a quote, "The intention is to make the thing, the eating, the walking, into an offering to the Lord. There are lots of ways to make something an offering." So I was just really interested in that. And it's exciting to me to see a question that might get passed over, like, why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? And then to have someone like Warren really weave it in into this modern way that connects with people's everyday lives. I mean, eating, walking, sleeping, these are pretty basic things. And, you know, expand that even farther. You know, how do people pray? How do they, she says, keep silent? And how do we do all of those things, she says, in a way that brings intention and makes it into an offering to God?
Well, we have another Duke faculty member who you've chosen to help, and I'm not as familiar with Luke Powery as I am with Lauren Winner, but the question that he chose is the question that maybe, that is very relevant, and one which is very familiar, and one which troubles us as each of us tries to work out our own relationships with God. But this is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And most of us who've read the Gospels don't forget this one, do we? I mean, this is not one
not a sleeper. Remember. Right, people remember this question. And Luke Powery is the dean of the chapel at Duke University, and he also teaches preaching. And when I sent this question to him, I sent him the idea for the book, he jumped and said, "I want to do this question."
Oh, he did.
He went right for it. Yeah, he was.
He was one of those. Did you give some people an early chance to choose the question? He was one of the early choosers.
He got in there.
He got
right
the best
away
one.
Like, I need to do this question, the thing that was so powerful about his piece is he brought this into modern race relations in the United States. You know, there's been so much drama really happening around the country, and thinking about it as a cry of lament. You know, he says, "Do you hear the cries of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice? Do you hear, 'Help, don't shoot, I can't breathe. My God, why?'" And when you connect those stories of, you know, today in America with Jesus' experience on the cross of feeling abandoned and forsaken and questioning why in the face of injustice, it's really powerful.
Well, it's great to put it in the context of race relations, and it's not just in the South anymore, but all over the country, that we seem not to be able to deal with this challenge in the most productive way, and sometimes we just throw up our hands and say, you know, well, gosh, God, why aren't you helping us take care? You know, why aren't you helping us take care of this situation? But otherwise, on this one, the power for me in this passage, and you didn't ask me to write a commentary, but it is that we go through our whole life thinking, God, you know, I mean, we say it softly, we try not to do it irreverently, but we're saying, you, why aren't you taking care of this problem? How can you let people suffer, and how can you let these people out in California be mowed down by just people for one reason or another? Guys, why have you forsaken us? We ask this question all the time. So, having Luke Powery come in on it from his perspective and others is dealing with the same question, even in your book, is helpful. But what are you going to give us? When are you going to give us a real answer to this question?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the questions remind us that sometimes there aren't answers in the way that we want. Sometimes there are just the questions, and answers come in the living and seeing what, you know, how people respond in the face of some of these questions that every generation, as you say, can ask. People all over the world can ask. And, you know, the question itself, my God, why have you forsaken me, is a question of lament. And it ties into the tradition in Psalm 22, a loud cry of lament. And those laments, you know, that is for Jesus to embody that as a viable and important kind of response just in life when these things come, I think that's really powerful for every generation. And Luke says, you know, don't underestimate the loud cry of Jesus, because it is that cry that opens up God's future for us and gives us access to God's presence in the world and our lives. He says, God is still present in the cry.
Well, if you joined us late, we're visiting with Elizabeth Diaz. We're talking about it's her book, although it's written by more than 70 other people with her. The book is What Did Jesus Ask? And she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Elizabeth Diaz. She is a editor, a writer for Time Magazine in the religion and politics areas and other things as well. I'm sure, Elizabeth, you get assignments all over the place. But your focus today with us is talking about your book, What Did Jesus Ask? Christian Leaders Reflect on His Questions of Faith. And we've talked about some of our friends here in the Chapel Hill, Durham area from the Duke Divinity School in Duke Chapel. I get how am I going to say this? But from the pulpit, in my church, we often hear about Barbara Brown Taylor and her perspective on the challenges of the Christian religion. And you picked her out to take a question that Jesus asked, can any one of you by worrying add a single hour to your life? And Elizabeth, this was one of those that I didn't remember. This was one of those questions.
And yet we think about worry all the time, don't we?
Yeah,
we're always worrying about something or other. And the question, you know, can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Barbara's reflections, like all of her work, is just beautiful. And she talks about looking out her kitchen window one morning and seeing the bird feeder and watching a tabby cat staring at it, you know, ready to pounce, and a hawk looking down at the little targets of the birds below, and the cardinals at the feeder, you know, they weren't nervous. And so she used that as a way in. You know, she says she doesn't think it's fair for Jesus to ask people about their anxiety level and then point to the birds of the air as a model. You know, do birds of the air have mortgage payments? Do lilies of the field have aging parents who depend on them for long-term care? And then only humans have problems like these. So it's an interesting juxtaposition and way in to a question that has real relevance to everyone's life. And, you know, slightly tangentially, I was really moved, of course, by all of the writers in this book, but many of the women who wrote for this book really took these questions to heart, very personal reflections, went really deep. And as an interesting parallel, one of the themes I noticed that I hadn't before was how often Jesus asked questions about women. And really bringing women's stories to the forefront. You know, some of the questions, do you see this woman? Woman, why do you involve me? Why are you bothering this woman? And it's an interesting theme to see, okay, Jesus was drawing attention to the women in his day who might not have been in his immediate inner circle of the 12 disciples, but who have really valuable and for Jesus cherished role in life and in sharing his message.
Well, this is quite interesting, and maybe we'll talk some more about Jesus's questions that had to do with women if we have time later on. But you know, before the break, we talked a little bit about the question of my God, why have you forsaken me? And in that context, worrying about many things which some Christian leaders would argue that God would want us to be worried about the race relations in our context. We're worried about the refugees, worried about the kinds of things that are happening economically throughout our country in an unfair way. So how do you and Barbara Brown Taylor deal with the idea that and Jesus, how do you three deal with the idea that maybe you really do want me to be worried about a lot of these things?
Well, I think it's a good reason to point out why there are many questions. There isn't just one. Jesus didn't ask just this question. That would be pretty limiting for us. Mm. But he asked many, and the stories for each are just as important. You know, if it had only been, why are you worrying? That would be a pretty different vision of what kind of gospel Jesus was sharing. But he elevated all of these things, and the challenge for us is to hold them all together.
Well, I didn't warn you about this, and I apologize, Elizabeth, but you mentioned about Jesus's questions about women, and you have a question that was dealt with by Amy Butler, who's the pastor at the Riverside Church in New York, a famous church,
yeah.
One I'd always wanted to visit. So I was interested in her piece, which is around Jesus's question of, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? And what is that scripture about, and how does Amy Butler deal with that?
Mm-hmm. So that context, women, where are they? Has no one condemned you? Is in the story of Jesus' encounter with a woman caught in adultery. And when he was teaching in a town square, local leaders brought in a woman who they were accusing of adultery. And Jesus starts, you know, drawing in the sand. And eventually, you know, no one can throw the first stone. Because everyone has sinned.
Yeah, we remember that quote, don't we?
Right. And to think, you know, we remember that part, but do we remember at the end, that at the end it's an encounter between no one else but this woman and Jesus, and how does Jesus respond? He asks the question. And it's different maybe, than just having a definitive answer, right? It's about the encounter and the interaction that Jesus has with the woman there at the end and inviting her to realize the whole of the situation that everyone else has sinned as well.
Well, did he let her off the hook?
No one stoned anybody. Amy Butler talks about the gift that Jesus then gave the crowd that day, that Jesus is not afraid to tell the truth about what it means to be human. And that's a gift not just for the woman, but for everyone else who had to back off and realize that they're human as well. And so just by asking that simple question, Jesus opened the possibilities of healing for the crowd and for the woman he was talking with.
Well, we're visiting with Elizabeth Dyer. She is we're doing it in the context of her book, What Did Jesus Ask? Christian Leaders Reflect on His Questions of Faith. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Elizabeth Diaz, and she is the author of, we're dealing with her book, What Did Jesus Ask? Christian Leaders Reflect on His Questions of Faith. Elizabeth, this is both fun and it's also stimulating, and to a certain extent, you're raising some uncomfortable, you and Jesus have raised some uncomfortable questions. I mentioned that I wanted to talk about Walter Brueggemann because he's someone that my pastor sometimes deals with, and I guess it's because he's another Southerner. And the question that comes up that is the basis of his commentary is one that I'd forgotten about, but we do not forget about the situation in which it came up. But the question is, why are you talking about having no bread? And it's in the context of one or the other or both of the feeding of the many thousands in the Gospels.
Right, and Walter reflected on this question. His meditation is a poem.
Prayers,
this type of thing. But it's really fun bringing it into today's context. I mean, some of the words in his poem, he says, we still talk about having no bread or not enough, or bread that is organic or gluten-free. And it kind of broadens. I thought that those lines specifically, you know, sometimes we're not just asking about not having any bread at all, any food. Sometimes today people are going, well, why don't I have this special kind of bread, or it meets my specific need. And those words really landed the question home, I think, in today's context.
Well, getting a poem in response to your question, did it surprise you, or did he warn you that was what he was going to do?
No. Well, that's his style, and that's part of the beauty of the book. You know, we've got everything from poems to some of the musicians incorporated their song lyrics. You may be familiar with the song In Christ Alone, which is sung in churches around the country almost every Sunday. And the Gettys, Keith and Kristen Getty, who were writers of that song, incorporated some of their song lyrics into their reflections. So it keeps it really personal, and it's a reminder of just all the different forms of expression that people have in response to Jesus.
Well, we've talked about some of my, I guess, my favorites. I wondered if your favorite might be the first one when we have a chance to meet the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Whether it's you got him first just because you've got it in order in the way it comes up.
It's in order, yeah. The gospel, we went with the gospel order for
so
the question.
Just coincidentally.
Straightforward and easy and fair way to do it. So it was really just by chance or providence, as one might say, that his reflection came first. But it's a really great tone setter for the book.
Tell us about it.
And you know, it's funny, people always ask me, oh, which are some of your favorites? And I find, and this is similar in reporting too, that some of the insights that stick with me the longest aren't always from the, quote, the big names, the people that everybody knows. Let me point to one by J. Jean Luen Yang, who is a Catholic man and also the designer of the Superman comic strip. Mm. And so he designed his reflection in actual comic design. So his question is, why question me? And one of the things he draws that made this really just very salient for me, he says, you know, how does Jesus say the question? And then he draws different versions of how Jesus might have said it. You know, was Jesus indignant? Was he frightened? Was he calmly confident? And it's a reminder, we often put on to the scripture a perspective just by how we read something. Just we might automatically assume Jesus is angry and asking something, or we might assume that his face looks kind of sad or something like that. But the reality is, we don't know what his facial expression was. And so there's many ways of interpreting a passage that might initially seem clear-cut.
Can we get that? You make me want to go back and read that that again. We talked that the Archbishop's commentary was providentially at first, but it comes because what you've done is to order the book sort of in the same order that the Gospels would order, and this is the first Matthew. Chapter 5 is the first question that you deal with. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? What does that question mean? And how does the Archbishop deal with it?
Well, there are many ways in which we could hear that. You know, I think, you can apply it in any kind of context, right? If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? I can hear that. You know, I'm based in Washington, D.C., so imagine hearing that question in the context of all the political arguments and infighting that's been happening of late, especially with a presidential election on the way. Or you can hear it, you can think about it for a child in a classroom who is dealing with bullying and trying to figure out, you know, how do you love in the face of something like that? And how do you also protect yourself? You think of it for parents, you know, dealing with their parents, maybe. And it's just, there's an infinite number of contexts in which you can hear this question. And the Archbishop of Canterbury opened his piece with a line from the poet T.S. Eliot, who says, "Oh, my soul, be prepared for him who knows how to ask questions." And, it's a great opener for thinking of all of the contexts that these questions can be heard in, and really pointing everyone back to, well, who is the question asker, and what does it say about that person? And for Jesus, you know, what is he doing by asking these questions, and what kind of community is he trying to build?
Well, we're coming to the end of our conversation. I think from my experience talking to people who are editors of books that have the contributions of 4, 5, or 9, or 10 contributors, it is a very, very hard task to manage those contributions. But you seem to be very upbeat about your relationships with your contributors and what you've been able to accomplish. Was it as easy as you're making it seem?
Well, I think, it was a real gift for me to be able to meet all of these people in a deeper way than maybe I do when I'm reporting, and to hear from them and to see their excitement about the questions. You know, I think I get excited anew every time I start talking about the questions, because also it's a very human enterprise, and I really appreciate that they took that seriously in thinking about the divine Jesus and the human Jesus, and what does that mean, and what does it mean for them personally, for their communities, their families, and then what does that mean for a generation of people who are trying to follow the gospel? And it's especially appropriate coming into the Christmas season. So, yes, I'm excited.
Well, thanks to you, Elizabeth Diaz, and thanks, Diaz, and thanks, thanks to all of your contributors. Thanks for helping us see the gospel in a different light. And thanks for taking time to visit with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy holidays.
Same to you. And thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.